No matter your passions, your interests, your strengths, your skills, or even your ambition, our careers can be about as predictable as the winner of the Super Bowl. Now, nothing is achieved without diligent and dedicated work, but timing or being at the right place at the right time is just as vital for success. And of course, the autonomous car industry is no exception to this. Welcome to the Future Car Podcast. I'm your host, Ed Bernardin, the VP of Strategic Automotive Initiatives at Siemens Digital Industries Software. And our guest today is Carl Yanema. He's the president and CEO of Motional, the Hyundai Aptiv autonomous driving joint venture. And Carl truly embodies having a relentless work ethic while at the same time opening up your sail to let the wind guide your career. And on the podcast, we're going to discuss his journey from an award-winning fiction writer to earning a PhD at MIT to founding Newtonomy. It's a startup that he later sold to Delphi for over $400 million. And to now becoming an industry leader running the joint venture with Hyundai. Carl is going to provide valuable insights, of course, on autonomous cars from his diverse experience. But at the end of the interview, if you stick around, we also find time to discuss some other really important topics that I know are on the top of everyone's mind, including if one day robot cars might fall in love. Welcome to the Siemens Future Car Podcast, and today we have with us the president of Aptiv Autonomous Mobility, Carl Yanema. Welcome to the Future Car Podcast, Carl.
Great to be here, Ed. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Carl has experience in the autonomous car industry. In 2013, he founded a company called Newtonomy, and this was, I guess you could say, in the early days of autonomous cars, well before many people were even talking about it. And then within 4 short years, you were able to sell your company. You were acquired by Delphi Automotive and then became the president of one of their spinouts. What was the motivation or the inspiration that drove you to start Newtonomy back then?
Well, I will tell you that when we started Newtonomy, I thought we were too late in 2013. I thought we were probably going to miss the boat. You know, my background is in the academic world. I went from Michigan. I moved to Boston to go to graduate school at MIT in 1995. And I never left MIT. I did a PhD there, then stayed on and started a research lab there. Did research in robotics for many years. And in particular, I did research in mobile robotics, which is essentially robots on wheels or legs or some other form of locomotion. And those systems, when I started doing the research in, you know, the early 2000s, were pretty poor in terms of functionality. They didn't do a whole lot, but over time, you know, performance increased. The system started getting better and better. They started getting bigger as well. I started doing some work with automotive companies. And when you squinted at it, you could see that someday these robots that we were developing, these robotic cars, might actually be able to be products that could be put on the road. Together with a colleague, a fellow named Emilio Frizzoli, we both looked at each other one day and realized that the timing seemed right to start an autonomous vehicle company. Now, I mentioned that we felt like we were going to miss the boat. We felt like we were actually too late. That's in part because a few years prior to us starting the company, there was a landmark event called the DARPA Urban Challenge. This was a government-sponsored R&D initiative where they offered prize money to research universities and other groups, teams essentially, that could put a robotic car on the road in a closed course and have it do a series of tasks, autonomous driving tasks. This was, you know, long before anyone thought that autonomous driving in an urban setting was really possible, but the teams went out. Many of them showed that they can put a credible autonomous vehicle on the road. So this had happened a few years before. There had been progress in the academic community. There had not been a lot of commercial activity, but we felt that the time was right to start an entity. In retrospect, we were indeed one of the earlier entrants in the space. We were able to build a great company and a great brand, which we were both very proud of. And then we agreed to join Delphi, then Delphi, now Aptiv, in 2017.
Back in 2013 and the years before that, or when the DARPA challenge was occurring, you were interacting, it sounded like, with the OEMs on the commercial side. What were they thinking back then of autonomous cars? Were they really looking at them seriously? Do you think that they felt that they were still a ways out?
I think there was, it really depended who you spoke to. But broadly speaking, in the automotive industry, there was a healthy degree of skepticism that we would ever have fully autonomous vehicles or even really highly automated vehicles on our roads. And then when you dug a little bit deeper, there was a wide range of perspectives on, you know, how we might even start to think about developing this technology. So for us, engaging with OEMs as roboticists, we weren't really speaking the same language. Let me put it that way. We were coming at the technology question from a very different perspective. We said, well, look, this is how we teach robots how to perceive the world, how to drive, how to make decisions. And this same approach can work for cars. Now, that was a very different perspective than an automotive engineer who had developed some, let's say, ADAS functions in their career. Different approach, different process, kind of different philosophy. So again, I think there was skepticism that, you know, these folks from the robotics community really knew what it took to put automotive technology on the road. There was skepticism that we could ever have sufficient sensing capability, compute capability at a price point, you know, that would be relevant for the automotive community. This was before, I would say, there was really a lot of thinking gone into business model and how we might be actually able to use this technology in fleets rather than in personally owned vehicles. So, you know, we were at the very beginnings as an industry of understanding both the technology and the business model implications of autonomy.
Do you think it was easier for you as a roboticist to learn, let's say, car speak, or was it easier for the people that were the car guys, right? Or was it easier for them to learn robotic speak?
I know I grew up outside Detroit, so my first summer internship when I was an undergraduate at the University of Michigan was with General Motors. So I was a summer intern at GM for 3 years, learned a little bit of the car speak. I wouldn't say I was ever an official card-carrying car guy because I wasn't there long enough, but knew enough to be dangerous. I think that helped me immensely, I'll say. When we came as Newtonomy and tried to engage with the OEMs of the world, look, I think it's helpful to have an appreciation of the complexity that goes into creating a passenger vehicle that has to run for 100,000 plus miles in many years with a warranty claim profile that's low enough for you to turn a profit on the thing. It's really, really hard to do. I think in the industry, let's say the robotics and autonomous driving industry, I'll admit, I think there was probably a certain degree of arrogance at one point where had you surveyed the landscape and asked people, describe the autonomous driving problem. What is the core problem in a nutshell? I think people would say, well, it's a software problem. Everyone would have said that. We can write the software and do that robustly and reliably. We've cracked the code. Fast forward a few years, and I think that tune has changed a bit. People really appreciate that it's not just a software development problem. It's an integration problem with a very, very complex piece of hardware. And so, you know, understanding and appreciating the complexity and challenge associated with building a car, with integrating software with a car, you know, we did have a healthy appreciation of that at Newtonomy. It's one of the things I will tell you that motivated us to join Delphi, because Delphi and Aptiv, what they do as their core business and generate, you know, billions of dollars of revenue every year is doing exactly this, integrating technology with passenger vehicles, validating that technology, ensuring that it can operate reliably and robustly. So that appreciation, I think, served us well.
Having been an entrepreneur myself and still working with some of the founders that started our company, we always look back fondly to those early years when, you know, there was three of us or five of us. If you look back on your days at Newtonomy, what were the most fun days, the most challenging, the best, the worst? What do you miss, maybe?
Well, you know, in some ways you miss it all, but you don't miss it in the sense that joining a large company, it's a very, very different experience, but it's also comes with, you know, many, many positives. You know, we now at Aptiv have access to resources that we never would realistically have had access to at a startup. We have expertise to draw on that we would have had a whole lot of difficulty attracting to a startup. So there's a lot of positives that have come out of joining a larger company, you know, without doubt. Being at a startup, you know, it's really like having a small family. A startup really is in many ways like a family. People join the family because they feel a strong commitment and sense of identity with the mission. And that's very, very powerful. It's something that's more difficult to achieve, I think I can say, in a larger enterprise. So that's the aspect that I think when people look back at small startups, that maybe typically they miss. It's that real sense of community and family and identifying with the mission in a very, very deep and intense way. Now, what you tend to forget about are the stress-filled long nights when, you know, the bank balance is running low, when investors are kind of skeptical or deciding whether or not to participate in the next round. You know, it's a high wire act. It certainly is. Again, that's right for some people, not right for all. It's right for some people at certain times of their careers and their lives. I had a great experience as a startup founder. I certainly learned a lot because you get exposed to every aspect of the business. You know, you have to. There's no one else to do it, right? And have definitely learned a lot and had a lot of fun here at Aptiv.
You could probably take what you just said and apply that to any type of a startup, right? You tend to remember the fun days, but then you forget when you slept overnight at the office, right? Getting the next version of a software to work. But if you looking back, what do you think was key to making you so successful? I mean, you went from a startup to being acquired by Aptiv in I think it's 4 short years at a very nice price too.
Well, timing, I think, is a big part of it. Look, I think timing, you know, obviously having a good team, good technology, strong sense of the market. But those last three, I think you typically in a market, you'll find a number of startups that have very smart people that with great credentials, that have a great plan. But being first, being early, it's hard to put a value on that. I mean, you were there or you weren't. There's a lot of value in being one of the first, and we certainly capitalized on that. And so I don't want to write it all off to timing and luck, but I also don't want to say that we had a, you know, clear plan, we executed, we were these all-seeing geniuses who understood the business, because it wasn't all that either. It's a combination of making good decisions, having good people, but also being in the right place at the right time, certainly.
Well, since you were at Aptiv, I think one of the, you could call it a major accomplishment, is the investment that Hyundai has made. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we're really excited about this joint venture. It's a JV, a 50-50 JV between Aptiv and Hyundai Motor Group. You know, I mentioned a moment ago that this isn't just a software problem. Autonomous driving is a software problem. It's a hardware problem, and it's an integration problem with a vehicle platform. And we at Aptiv were really focused on the software part, had a good expertise in the integration part. We're not building cars. You know, we're not a car manufacturer. That's the part that we weren't doing. Now, Hyundai, one of the world's largest automakers, they know better than anyone how to build very reliable, cost-optimized cars and deploy them in just about every market in the world. So you put these two things together, you know, Aptiv software expertise, integration and validation expertise, and Hyundai's vehicle manufacturing expertise, and you've got just an incredibly powerful combination. I'm really excited about this partnership.
I have to mention the tweet that President Trump put out. I'm going to read it. Big news by Hyundai, Kia, and Aptiv on the $4 billion joint venture to develop autonomous driving technologies in the USA. That's a lot of dollars and jobs. Great job coming back to America. I'm sure you got a lot of feedback on that tweet. Were you ever able to talk to President Trump about this?
Well, we weren't. We weren't. We were certainly flattered that there was attention to the news of the deal, one of Hyundai's largest investments outside of Korea in their history. There's a lot of dollars at stake, as was mentioned. Again, when we look out at the competitive landscape, we see companies that have maybe great software skills. We see other companies that we feel may have real expertise and advantages on the sensing side or the hardware side. But it's not very common that you have the combination across the full spectrum, the software, the integration, and the vehicle manufacturing. So we feel very unique in that regard.
When you think about autonomous vehicles, especially with you coming from Detroit, right? Detroit was Motor City, the center of the automotive industry. And now you've got Silicon Valley. Certainly there's hotspots of autonomous technology coming up in Asia. And here you are in Boston. How do you think it's, you know, shaking out? Is this going to become a Silicon Valley? Is that going to become the new Motown of the United States?
Yeah, I think there's a broadening of the footprint of where this technology is being developed. There's no question about that. As software has gained in importance, you know, I mentioned a minute ago, it's there's software, there's hardware, there's integration, there is all those things, but software has certainly increased its importance. You know, the areas of the country where you find that real depth of talent for software development, it's not the traditional automotive development areas. It's that's simply not the case. So Silicon Valley certainly has risen in prominence as an area to have a presence, to have a team. But it's not the only place. You know, we at Aptiv, we're here in Boston. I'm talking to you today from Boston, and we're thrilled to be here in Boston. We found it to be a great source of talent for individuals who can develop software, who can develop algorithms. We have a presence in Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh is probably the world's foremost center for robotics talent, in no small part due to the proximity to Carnegie Mellon. So Pittsburgh, another real major center worldwide for autonomous driving. We've also got a presence in Singapore. And Singapore, in terms of, you know, Southeast Asia, it's a real magnet for talent. So you find a lot of people with skills across the software development space, but into robotics and machine vision and other, you know, very important areas for us. So I think broadly speaking, you know, Silicon Valley certainly is on everyone's map in the auto industry, but people are thinking more broadly than just Silicon Valley. It's now a global hunt for talent in this space.
You have autonomous cars now running in Las Vegas and running in Singapore, two very different cities, right? Different cultures. I'm sure they probably have different approaches to public transportation, transportation in general, and certainly to autonomous cars. What can you tell us about the differences between deploying something in Las Vegas versus, say, in Singapore?
You know, every city is different. Every city really is different. It may seem obvious, but until you get on the road in a city, you don't fully appreciate how unique every city is. We've come to the conclusion ultimately that when we enter a new city, we don't know exactly, we can't predict what will be different, but we know something will be different. I'll give you an example for Boston first. You know, we've been driving in Singapore, as you mentioned. We had code that was working great in Singapore. We came to Boston, and the first thing that happened, I want to say on our first day of testing, driving down the road, is the car encountered a flock of seagulls, because we're testing here in the seaport near the water in Boston. Well, we hadn't seen any seagulls in Singapore. These are pretty big birds, big enough so that when they were clustered together, you know, the car thought it was, I don't know what it thought. It was a stone, a rock, a big object. And so the car sat patiently waiting for the seagulls to leave when, of course, they weren't going anywhere. So you see, you know, new animals that you hadn't seen, perhaps vehicle types in Boston. Again, we have articulated buses, these very long buses with a joint in the middle. Well, the vehicle didn't quite know what to make of those until we explained that actually, yes, buses can bend in half. And so there's an updating, a training process, adding classes to your perception algorithms, to your decision-making code that's required. And that's beyond just the obvious. You know, Singapore versus Las Vegas, to get to your question, Ed. Well, in one city, we drive on the right side of the road. In the other city, we drive on the left side of the road. So if nothing else, you have to be sure that your policy engine, your decision-making software, can adapt to that sort of, you know, radical change. But Vegas and Singapore, Boston and Pittsburgh, you know, our other driving locations, they all give us a real diversity of experience on the road. It's across the entire spectrum in terms of weather, in terms of, I would say, type of road network. You know, for example, Boston being a fairly dense, old city by American standards, whereas Vegas is very much a grid, wider streets, kind of easier driving. Elevation changes we see in Pittsburgh in terms of the fact that it's a hilly town. We don't see that in our other driving sites. So when you put all of this together, you get that exposure to the diversity of experience that's really essential to build a robust autonomous vehicle. You know, we have cars on the road almost 24 hours a day. On a given day, probably just about 24 hours a day in some part of the world. And all that data is coming back to a central repository. So we're able to gain on a daily basis experience of driving from across the world, and that's very valuable.
How do you sort through all that data to figure out what's important?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And, you know, this is a nascent industry. And like any nascent industry, you first start building technology to solve core problems. Then along the way, you realize that in order to make progress, to continue to scale and to move quickly, you need better tools. Again, in new industries, often those tools don't exist. So you go out and start to build tools. And then you look up one day and your tools team is as big as your core development team. So autonomous driving is no exception. And look, it really impacts the P&L. The amount of data that we collect, if we were naive in our collection and processing strategy and how we retained it and how we transferred it around the world, you know, my budget for data would be bigger than anything else in the business. And we don't necessarily want that to be the case. So we're very thoughtful, and we built smart tools for looking at data triaging it, processing it to identify where the interesting parts of the data are, and maybe retaining only certain, you know, subsets of that data. And then, of course, building tools to visualize it, to interrogate it, understand what happened, when, and why from the car's perspective. So there's a lot of development that's gone into that question that you just asked, Ed. And at the end of the day, having good tools makes engineers much more efficient in their work and saves us a lot of money.
So it sounds like you had to develop some tools on your own to help you sort through these reams of data that you're getting. What are some of the other things that you had to do on your own that you didn't find available out there that were important for developing autonomous car tech?
Well, you know, again, we started from the position of writing software. Newtonomy was a software company. And there was a belief, I would say, at one point, if you built smart enough software, you could solve the entire problem and have a safe driverless car. At some point, you know, I think collectively the industry realized, well, hey, maybe that's true, but it sure would be nice to have better sensors and faster computers and a whole host of other things. Again, given that this was an asset industry, that ecosystem around next generation sensors, that was only just emerging. So there was a lot of work to do and kind of on the partnership front, working with startups, more experienced and larger sensor developers, compute system developers, on educating them on what this industry needed in terms of specifications and kind of, you know, going hand in hand with them on a process where they would develop prototypes, we would test them, we would give feedback. So that was another, I would say, part of the journey is helping to support the development, the sensor and the compute and the component architecture, really the partner base, I would put it. So software, really, I would say that's kind of the maturation of tools. But looking across to hardware, that's really been a partnership strategy that we've executed on.
I believe you use Siemens software product called Polarion for helping you sort your requirements for software. Is that right?
That's right. You know, we have drawn on, I would say, tools that have been used across various industries, and had to build some of our own tools. And now there are new tools that are being created by vendors, by partners, by startups, specifically for automated driving. So again, it's a little bit of a hybrid right now, where the industry is still young enough that we are putting together solutions from wherever we can find them.
And, you know, though, regardless of how good software becomes and hardware and sensors and the whole system, right, it seems that, and I believe this is true for Aptiv, that you still have a driver in the car. What are the plans for ultimately removing the human backup?
Well, our plan, which we're working very hard toward, as you can imagine today, is that we'll begin testing our system, our driverless system, without a safety driver in the car from 2020. And that will start in a, you know, relatively small geofenced area. Geofenced meaning we define the operating region and the operating conditions in a careful manner. The car can only operate within those conditions, doesn't operate outside those conditions. But that's 2020 for us. And, you know, really the way to think about it, this is the way we think about it at least, is that driverless is not a single definition. It's a moving definition, and it's an evolution. So we will start by operating in a driverless fashion in a fairly constrained environment. And over time, with every update to our code, we'll expand the operating region of that driverless system. So in the early days of driverless technology, and we're seeing this already today in the industry, you might look at it and say, well, it's a driverless car, but maybe it only drives in fair weather conditions in a fairly sleepy neighborhood. That's an important step to get to that driverless milestone. And again, as you expand capabilities, you unlock the potential markets that you can access with the technology. And so we see this evolution over time where we move from relatively less complex driving environments to relatively more complex driving environments.
The key is to be successful and provide something of value, but there's probably always going to be something that pops up. For instance, a thing that looks like a blob, which is really a flock of seagulls, say. Over the past year or so, what would you say were some of the bigger surprises?
The difficult thing about what we call corner cases, which is another word for saying, you know, highly unexpected events, The difficult thing about them is you can't anticipate them because they are corner cases. They are things that no matter how long you sit in a room and kind of rack your brain trying to envision a scenario that would stump the car, no matter how long you do that, the natural world is going to throw a situation at you that you did not consider. So we have a process today internally where we do an extensive amount of simulation before we put any vehicle on the road. So anytime we have a new build of code, we run it through a catalog of many, many thousands of simulated scenarios. And we have processes for generating randomized simulation scenarios. So you might think, okay, well, if we're randomizing, we really will capture these unique, almost impossible to predict scenarios because, you know, we'll stumble onto something random. But even despite that, we see things in on-road testing that, you know, we hadn't anticipated. One example would be, and I can't remember exactly when this one occurred, but in Singapore, I believe there was an opening of a new restaurant, must have been a chicken restaurant, because there was a fellow wearing a chicken suit, was walking around the road, and okay, you train your perception systems to recognize a whole range of humans, large and small. To date, at that point, we hadn't recognized, trained them to recognize anyone in a chicken suit. So there will be things that is just outside the scope of your simulator and even its capability to randomize. It really points to the value of on-road testing. You know, for us, when we're developing our software, the philosophy to ensure safety is that we do extensive simulation, we do extensive testing in a closed course setting, and then we do testing on-road with safety drivers in the car so that we can ensure when we hit these unique, you know, cases that the car is going to react properly and the safety driver is there to ensure that that's the case.
In some ways, you're actually quite lucky because the human in a chicken suit is almost just like a larger version of your seagull. So you could probably reuse some of that code, one would think, right?
There you go. There you go. Yeah, maybe with a little adaptation, we got our chicken suit detection.
So you mentioned earlier autonomous cars being a part of a system, multiple systems, right? Integrating together and working together. If you take that to the next level, especially with every city being a little bit different, what are your thoughts on the need for or role of, say, connected vehicles, vehicle-to-infrastructure communication, vehicle-to-vehicle, vehicle-to-pedestrian? How important is that going to be for autonomous cars to be successful?
Well, connectivity is important. You know, today in our activity in Las Vegas, where we are giving rides to members of the public every day, you know, we have a partnership with Lyft in Las Vegas. And so if you go to Vegas today, when you listen to this podcast and you open your Lyft app, you can hail one of our cars and take a ride anywhere in the downtown Vegas or Strip area. To date, we've given over 75,000 rides. Just about everybody who takes a trip in our car gives us a 5-star rating. Our current rating is, you know, 4.96 out of 5. So we're very proud of that. And that activity relies in part on communication with infrastructure, with the traffic lights around Las Vegas. We use DSRC communication technology. Now, in other areas that we test, in Singapore, in Boston, and Pittsburgh, we don't rely on that particular type of technology. We've got other strategies. But I'm a believer that connectivity, whether it's with other cars, whether it's with infrastructure, it's certainly a key enabler. In some ways, it's essential. Now, to be clear, our offering, our system that we're developing will rely on what we call a teleoperation system. And that's a remote operator that can monitor the performance of the vehicle, the autonomous vehicle, could communicate with a rider in the vehicle as needed to give information or to update route, et cetera, and can potentially send commands to the vehicle if the vehicle needs support. And so that clearly requires a high fidelity, reliable communication link. So there's different ways that connectivity and communication will be used in autonomous vehicles, but certainly an essential ingredient when we think about their eventual rollout at scale.
How do you think the performance compares, say, in Las Vegas, where you have DSRC and you have communication, vehicle to infrastructure communication, in the cities where you don't? Do you see an improvement in performance in some way?
Well, it really depends on what you're using the communication for. Traffic lights are a good example where we can communicate information about the state of the traffic light to the vehicle. Now, that's an example where because it is such an important thing you're detecting, the state of the traffic light, it's what we call a safety critical activity. You need to have multiple modes for detecting the state of that traffic light. And so in other cities, we have different ways to achieve, you know, those multiple modes. So difficult to compare apples to apples, to answer your question, Ed. So one of the things we're studying today, as we operate our different sites, we try to understand how different strategies, whether it's for communication, for perception, whatever the case may be, how they perform in different operating environments.
Well, in the few minutes we have left, I have to ask you, Carl, about your background as an author. You have quite a few publications out there, a couple to note, prize-winning publications. A Little Advance is one of them from 1998, which was the winner of the 1998 Playboy College Fiction Contest. And another one, On the Nature of Human Romantic Interaction, which received, it says here, the 2001 Paris Review Discovery Prize. I guess this is from the late 90s, early 2000s. Can you tell us a little bit about that and maybe how the experience in the world as an author has influenced you as a technologist in the world of autonomous cars?
Yeah, boy, you're taking me back here, Ed.
Well, it's always fun to look back, though, you said, right?
It is. Well, writing has been a big part of my life since I was a kid. You know, when I was growing up, my father was an engineer in the auto industry in the Detroit area. My mother was an aspiring fiction writer. So that was, I guess, the world of my possible occupation. So I thought I might try both. And for a while, I thought I would be a writer and a novelist when I grew up. Did publish a couple books. Proud of those works. A lot of work goes into writing a book, as I learned. It's a very hard activity, and one unfortunately that doesn't ultimately pay the bills. So transition and focus a little bit more on my engineering career since then. But certainly, you know, for me at least, what I appreciated in my writing and my experience from that is really the power of narrative, especially when you think about building an organization, building a company, and helping people understand, really draw a connection to the mission of the company and what you're doing and feel invested in that. It's about telling a story. It's not fiction. You know, I'm not talking about fiction here, but it's about finding a way to communicate with individuals and really both within an organization and then even when you speak externally. When you go explain to the rest of the world why what you're doing is important, it's finding a way to connect to the individual. And so ultimately, the power of narrative, you know, whether you're writing a novel, whether you're writing a short story, whether you're talking to the press, whether we're having this conversation now, it's an important skill to have, something I've thought about a lot over the years. Now, I will tell you, it's certainly not the same thing. Sitting in a room by yourself writing a book is very different than building a company, but it's something I hope to do again in the future, maybe when I get a little bit more free time.
There are several publications here in the area of romance. How'd you pick that topic?
Well, they're actually, so the titles are maybe a little bit misleading. Most of my stories were about scientists, engineers, and mathematicians. There was some romance here and there in the title. Hey, you got to get readers somehow, right? But there was a lot of story about scientists and trying to understand the world through the lens of science and sometimes succeeding and sometimes, you know, not so much.
Well, listen, I got one final question for you, one that ties together the world of romance and autonomous cars. So certainly autonomous cars, right, with vehicle-to-vehicle communication are starting to communicate with each other. So do you think if autonomous cars could really talk to each other, have a real conversation, that someday they might actually fall in love with each other? You think that's a possibility?
Okay. Well, I don't know if we want to go there, Ed. I think I hope that's not the case. Let me put it that way. I think that'll cause more challenges than we have time to solve. And I think our poor developers have enough problems to deal with without having to worry about spats and infighting among autonomous cars. We'll leave that to the humans.
All right. Yeah, you stole my girlfriend or my boyfriend or whatever it might be.
Exactly.
Thanks so much for joining us today, Carl. And a big thanks, of course, to all our listeners. For more information about Siemens Digital Industries Software, make sure to visit us at plm.automation.siemens.com. And until next time, I'm Ed Bernardin, and this has been the Future Car Podcast.